In 2022, preliminary data from the United Network for Organ Sharing reports 42,887 organ transplants were performed in the United States, the new annual record. Welcome to WonderCast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness. February is American Heart Month. In this space, it is a welcomed opportunity to take pause and focus on the individuals that work day in and out to help meet the needs of families facing ongoing cardiac care. Join us today as we visit with Kristen Mollier, certified transplant social worker, providing care to her hospital community and beyond.
Well, hi, my name is Kristen. I'm one of the social workers in Houston, Texas. I work in the Texas Medical Center at a heart transplant and LVAD program. For those of you not familiar with LVAD, it's the left ventricular assist device and also known as a heart pump. So sometimes it helps people that are waiting for a transplant or may not be a candidate for a heart transplant as another option. I've been a heart transplant and LVAD social worker for about 7 years. Time has flown because I love it, but I've been in a hospital social work for my entire career as a social worker. I went to college in East Texas in Nacogdoches and just made my way down 59 South for those Texans listening and found myself in the medical center at Houston. I have a little one at home. She's my pride and joy. And in my free time, I also do a podcast as well. So for those listening that are interested, it's Beats by Social Work, where we talk about all things transplant and LVAD from a social work perspective. So thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
Well, we are so glad to have you here, and we will be linking Beats by Social Work on our information below. So just keep tuned for that, listeners, and you can go to our website. If you are listening on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, sometimes those links don't go through as well. So just go back to our website and you can find all that information there. For National Heart Month here, the month of February, we are talking all things heart. And I think it's best to go to the expert, to the source, the people who are there every day. I can't believe you have been in your environment as long as you have through a pandemic, through all the changes of that, especially because when COVID first hit, our most vulnerable population were people with heart conditions or pre-existing heart conditions. So that definitely probably impacted your everyday life, and the fact that you have been able to keep going back and staying in the field, and that says a lot about where you work and your work ethic and the people you hopefully you work around.
Oh, absolutely. We have an amazing team at our program, and we very much are like family. So it makes the day go by so beautifully.
I think it's very unique because the longevity of patients that come through there are there for a long time, I would imagine. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So especially because we take on some of the more critically ill patients than, let's say, a more rural program might be able to accept. So a lot of our patients find themselves in cardiogenic shock or suddenly with heart failure, or they may have been compensating well with it. But what that means is that their treatment course in the hospital takes longer too. So we do see a lot of patients that end up having to wait in the hospital for a transplant or have a longer recovery after a surgery.
As a way to kind of connect your version of social work to some of the versions that maybe other listeners might be tuning in, experiencing in their own personal life, I would love it if we could kind of get a little glimpse, like a day in the life for you. And it doesn't have to be like at 11:35, I eat breakfast or, you know, whatever. But just more like kind of how you deal with your acuity list, how you do your rounding. Do you do rounding? How many people are on your team? Kind of things along the lines of that.
Sure. So we are actually a team of four, soon to be five, as we do now have a new lung transplant social worker. So hopefully when this drops, she will be boots to the ground and we will be happy to have her. But a day in the life of transplant social work, specifically cardiac transplant and heart and lung, We do start our day at 7 a.m. And so we start rounds at 7. And that's where we find out all the admissions that happened maybe the night before, the patients that are getting ready to discharge, or any complex cases. And that's when we also find out if someone's going to be evaluated for a transplant or an LVAD. And then, that's one of the reasons why I love this job. It is, you never know what you're going to walk into every single day. I'm sure you can imagine being in the ER setting. It is luck of the draw. So I am clinic-based. So that does mean that my office is in the clinic. I am primarily outpatient, but I do have my patient population on the inpatient side in the ICU setting. And so I evaluate patients for an LVAD and a heart transplant, more the psychosocial, like how you're going to cope with it, how your family is going to support you, what are things that we may want to look out for. I do those evaluations on an inpatient and outpatient side. So it's just luck of the draw some days.
You're just moving all the time. Would you say you have, I know in some units are pulmonary and trauma seasons, we have these types of year where it seems like there are certain times where you have bigger caseloads. Does that happen in the cardiac world, or do you feel like it's pretty evenly distributed throughout the whole calendar year?
I feel like overall it's evenly distributed. Of course, there are some times when there's a lull in evaluations, but that's usually compensated by patients that are having to stay in the hospital for a long time, or there's more of a clinic load. So it's a little bit like robbing Peter to pay Paul with your workload.
If we had some new grads that were listening, is the level of work that you do along the lines that they would be able to consider looking into, or is it more considered something that is advanced programming?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are considered, it's a clinical level of social work. And so I have my LCSW. So that is a post-grad 2-year clinical supervision after the MSW program. And I also have what's called a CCTSW MCS. That's a certified clinical transplant social worker and mechanical circulatory services credentialing. So that's an additional 2 years after the LCSW in specific transplant work. So what I would say is that there are some social workers in particularly smaller programs that have an LMSW, but it might be a little more challenging line of work for a new grad, mainly because a lot of programs really function on just one social worker, maybe two. And so we're lucky in our program to have 4, soon to be 5 of us. And so there's a lot of mentorship and we learn from one another very, very well. So I would say in a program like that, you would have more opportunity.
Have you always been drawn to the cardiac population?
Inadvertently. So it was not my intention. I've always been, I went into social work. I thought I was going to go into school social work and play therapy. That was my long-term goal, was to become a play therapist. And then when I sat with my intern placement specialist through the school that said, you know, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? I told her I'm okay with anything except hospice. My grandfather had recently passed away. I felt like I might not be comfortable with hospice, but because of limited placement opportunities, she said, okay, well, we'll put you in the hospital then. I was placed in the ICU. And so it was very close to palliative care and very close to hospice. So I ended up finding out that I had a real passion for palliative care and chronic illness. Then from there, cardiac just fell into place.
I do love that you were like, really anything but the people that are really close to edge of life and their final days, and you were put in the ICU.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I was put. Yeah. And so I think that was meant to be, because one of my goals for this year is to look more into palliative care credentialing, because I think that that's a big missing piece, especially in the cardiac world. In fact, we were talking with a palliative care physician recently, and he said, you know, the oncology side of things and cancer treatments, and they have a much closer relationship with palliative care. And they're 10 years ahead, if not more, than the heart failure world and their relationship with palliative care. So I hope to see that build a little better.
I do too, because there's so much benefit. I think people may be listening here at palliative care and think that we are talking no treatment. And that is actually the opposite. It is having a pain protocol. It is having a relationship with those physicians that specifically are there and the team as a whole to help support you in all of your care.
Absolutely. And I'll even add that it just opens the door to conversations because we all have 100% chance of dying. And so having what you want out of end of life, whenever that may be, is important.
Mm-hmm. And just because you are starting with palliative care services doesn't mean that you are giving a prognosis that you will die tomorrow. I feel like oftentimes the advanced planning is so helpful for your family, for yourself, for gathering your resources. There are so many resources that palliative care team is privy to that other areas of the hospital may not even know exist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I say that advanced care planning is the best gift that you can give your loved ones because it takes that off of their plate. And it's something that you can give them that you decided and they know what you want.
So if a family had come through overnight into cardiac care or or for either lung failure or heart failure, and they were on your services, how would they connect or find you? Or is it something where you find them in the hospital?
Sometimes it's a little of both. So one thing that I will add, you asked earlier, what's the day in the life of Kristen, the cardiac social worker? So I am a little different than the social worker in the hospital setting, the inpatient side that's predominantly placed inpatient or also known as the unit social worker. So anyone that comes into the hospital is going to have a unit social worker designated to their part of the hospital. That social worker is more responsible for discharge planning. Do you have a safe place to go? Do you have access to adequate, you know, food, electricity, water, your basic needs? And what services are you going to need to have a successful discharge? So there's that social worker. And then there's us, which is the transplant social workers. We don't do discharge planning. We're more clinic-based. We're clinical. So we're going to help you more with the mental health side of things, the coping, adjustment to illness, and then also have some of those tougher conversations and evaluate for transplant and an LVAD. So to answer your question a little more specifically of how someone would come in contact with me, typically you meet with the unit social worker just baseline as part of your discharge planning process. And then you'd meet with me after your doctors talk to you and say, listen, you're running out of outpatient treatment options. The medications aren't working. So we really need to start considering you for a transplant or an LVAD. They start the evaluation process, and that's when I come in. And for example, today I said this to a family. I said, well, I am part of the evaluation process. And so while all the doctors are doing scans and looking at pictures of your heart and lungs and everything in between, I am the one to help put a face and a name and a family behind all those pictures that they're taking of you. And so that's my job, which means I get to ask the nosy questions.
Yeah, which I love. And I think a lot of people traditionally in years past thought social work meant you had done something wrong and you were about to get in trouble. And that is not the case at all. A social worker is your very best advocate for getting the resources you need, for listening to what's going on in your home life in a way that physicians and nurses, not that they don't want to, it's just not, it's not their area of care at that time. They're trying to make sure your medications are correct or your physical needs are being met. And a social worker is there to help provide that psychosocial support and that ongoing level of personalized care, the whole picture.
Absolutely. You said it perfectly.
How do you find that balance of ongoing needs, balancing your own ongoing needs with the families versus the varied levels of cares that you might have? If you're on the outpatient side, I imagine that's kind of one section. But if you are getting pulled over to the ICU side, to some of your other families or the inpatient side, how do you balance that level of acuity between the back and forth?
Yeah. So a lot of that has to do with, again, you know, you never know what you're going to run into on a day-to-day basis. And so I do have to say, though, that a lot of times it's easier to balance it with the team that I have. So I have a, you know, with having a four-person team, we tag team very well, but I'm just open communication with my patients. Hey, listen, you know, I'm going to come back, but I do have some patients in clinic I need to see first. So I will be back by, you know, and if I'm not back by today, it's because an emergency came up. So I think that transparency is very important. So a patient's not lingering, wondering, are they going to come back? Are they not? What's going on? So that's really how I handle it.
What advice do you have for a family that might be kind of in that mucky space? I say mucky, but in that new kind of or ongoing hospitalization that's related to maybe a new part of their illness that hadn't been there before. What is something that you have for them to kind of help them with navigating that process?
I would say acknowledge your grief, that it's you oftentimes find yourself thrust into this situation that you never anticipated being in. Nobody plans to be in the hospital except the staff because it's their job. But this is a time of crisis. And so grieving over where you're at is an important part of that. And then I would also say that when you look at the possibility of a transplant, when you look at the possibility of an LVAD, to shift your perspective from it's going to cure my heart failure to it's a treatment. I think that a lot of times, it becomes very daunting and very overwhelming being evaluated. I will say a lot of times for patients, that's the hardest part of the process. And that can be very overwhelming too. With that being said, transplant isn't, a lot of times the movies make it look like, okay, we got our transplant, the end, and the movie ends, but it isn't. And so I've had many patients that tell me, I really thought that the transplant was just going to fix everything and then I would go back to normal life. And so shifting that gears a bit may make the adjustment a little bit easier.
Absolutely. Especially with that long road to recovery, if recovery is part of their story.
Absolutely. Because the reality of it too is not everyone is a candidate for these therapies. And so the evaluation phase can be very difficult. And sometimes we don't get the answers that we want. But yeah, everyone's story is different.
What would you say is one of your more common questions or needs that you get from the families you work with in the hospital or in your clinic?
Well, I get asked a lot of different questions, more for the logistics side of things. Will my insurance pay for my loved one to be my caregiver? What does this look like for me and my family? Short-term, long-term disability questions, but then more on the mental health and adjustment side of things, it's a lot of questions about their potential donor and how do you feel about your donor? I wouldn't be doing service to my patients if I didn't say you also are going to have feelings of guilt and feelings of grief related to how you respond to your donor. And those are normal and healthy reactions. So start thinking now about your future donor if you are being considered for a transplant or you're on the wait list for one.
You see those videos on TikTok and on TV and on YouTube about these people that find the donor's family and let them listen to their heart. And it's this, you know, very moving. How much of a reality would you say that is for a lot of people? Or is it more common that there is that level of separation from these families that you really will never get to know the family of the donor? And that more often than not, it's just your life and your legacy and what you choose to do with your body as you continue to get healthier?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I'm so glad that you asked it because social media has, and it's good because it brings awareness to becoming a registered donor and that donors are needed. But then at the same time, it is a little disillusioning that a lot of people are going to have this magical experience where the donor walks their daughter down the aisle at the wedding or their recipient walks the daughter down, those sorts of things, right? These magical moments. And I would honestly say that it happens about 50% of the time. And 50% of the time, if a recipient of a transplant reaches out, that they may hear from their donor family. And it may end at a letter just, you know, thank you, it meant a lot to hear from you, or the donor family initially reaching out. But then the other 50% of the time, their own grieving process doesn't align with that. And they're either not ready or don't want that to be part of their story.
So families are given the information of the donor family.
No, not necessarily. So okay. it is still anonymous. There is a third party, which is it's called an OPO, which stands for Organ Procurement Organization. So each region in the country is going to have an organization that deals is kind of that middleman between the donors and the recipients. So for us here in Houston, it's LifeGift. And for a large portion of Texans, it's LifeGift. And so they have a family coordinator that like if one of my transplant patients brings a letter to me, then I coordinate with her, make sure she gets the letter, and then she gets it to the correct donor family.
Perfect. So there is that level of professionalism and that go between. So that is nice to know that you have the option to have that closure, but the person who also is the family member grieving the loss of their loved one, they have that option whether or not they choose to receive that.
Absolutely. Perfect. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. I feel like that's something that people just don't know about and wouldn't know even the answer for. So thank you for providing that answer.
Yeah. And one thing that I will add to that, if I may, is there's a lot of pressure on organ recipients to, they feel like they've been given this tremendous gift and now they have to go climb Mount Everest or they have to go win a Nobel Peace Prize. And there's a huge pressure of now that I've been given the second chance of life, I have to do some miraculous thing. And I want to give whoever's listening that may be in that position permission to take that weight off of their shoulders and put that back down, because really just living is continuing that legacy and just living and really relishing in those small joys of life is what gives the gift of life meaning.
Oh, I love that. I think that that is the validation that so many people need. I think it takes some of that pressure off. I know I would be like, oh, am I doing it right? Am I living to my fullest? And I feel like that is a very hard battle to overcome. Like that is a hard mountain to climb, figuratively absolutely. And literally.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
What would you say is a big win in your line of work?
Oh, okay. So I have two, if I may share two stories.
I would love that.
Oh, good. So I will maintain HIPAA compliance and that sort of thing. So nothing I say will be Googleable. However, I have a patient who was actually one of the first patients that I evaluated for a transplant for an LVAD when I started this career. And so about 7 years ago, let's say six for margin of error, right?
Right.
6 years ago, I evaluated this patient for an LVAD. They had excellent support. They found themselves in a very emergent situation and in very unique situation. They got an LVAD. They were listed for transplant and they just got their transplant.
Oh my goodness. How wonderful. Just recently, like December, like this year.
Yes. Just in the last month, they received their transplants. And so they're doing great. And it just is a reflection in this particular story of the power of patience, the power of support, because they're that was not an easy road, and they'll be the first to admit it. But I think the reason it's a win for me is that it's like, well, they waited for transplant. They got their transplant. What's so special about that, right? It's because one of the things that they did so well was they didn't stop living life. And they shared that with the team in a very beautiful way. And so the second story or example of a win for me is those small joys. It's seeing my patient who's been in the hospital for 6 months walk down the hall for the first time. We have a bell, and when the patient leaves, they ring the bell. And so the bell ringing is huge. But then also what I will add, if part of their story is unfortunately withdrawal of care and palliative care, helping the family in legacy building and making sure that that part of their story is just as beautiful as well.
Yeah. Is it normal, would you say? I hate to say normal because there's no normative to anybody's line of care. I feel like our bodies all respond differently to treatment and treatment sure. options. But is it typical that there would be a very long wait between LVAD placement and transplant? Or can it vary just based on whether or not they can find a match, whether or not your body is in a place to do it, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so there are certainly different factors. And so in the example that I gave, that was longer than what you may typically see. And that was another reason why it just, you know, made it all sweeter at the end.
Yes.
But typically, I mean, it is on a case-by-case basis. So you're going to factor in their blood type, their body size, antibodies. So there's all these different medical components that are factored in. And then also time on the wait list. So if you have two people that are both a perfect match, but one has been waiting longer on the wait list, then that's factored in as well. So I think that there's this misnomer or this confusion that there's just some grand Word document out in the universe that literally someone sits at the computer and types names on a list in the order they want it to. And you know, if you have a buddy, then you can kind of nudge your way up to the top. It doesn't work that way. There's way more factored in.
Okay. So for the very last thing, is there anything else that you would like to add that you feel like we did not cover?
Oh, gosh. And it's so funny being on my own podcast. I ask this question all the time, but you're never prepared to answer it.
I know. I know. It's a pretty loaded question because you're like, oh, I'm sure there is. But if I say no, I sound like a debtor. But if I say yes, then yeah.
So you did ask how I manage my acuity level, all the different acuity levels, while also taking care of myself and making sure that there's balance, right? I think that's a big thing that we're all trying to strive for is balance. And I think that for those helping professionals that are listening, that finding that is important and having a self-care protocol. So if, let's say, it is a particularly demanding day, or there is a day where it is, there is a very high acuity. For example, this is certainly an extenuating circumstance, nor does it happen hardly ever. But there was one day when I had 5 emergent inpatient evals for heart transplants.
Wow.
And how do you balance that, right? And so I went and I started the evals. We divvied up the workload. We got it done. But you definitely found me outside kind of walking laps around the hospital in between evals just to get a little vitamin D. And I think that giving ourselves permission as helping professionals to fill our own cup so that we can continue to pour into others.
Yeah, that's incredible advice. 5 in one day. Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine what that paperwork looked, that documentation looked like. Oh,
that's, I know.
That's a lot. Well, perfect. Well, I am so grateful that you agreed to be my guest. With Wonders and Worries, we support caregivers and adults of all chronic illness. And so I feel like the heart community, there are so many people that chronic heart conditions, maybe it's you're waiting on a wait list for a transplant, or maybe it's something very much smaller and you just have hypertension or restrictions with what you can eat with your diet and your diet controlled. But regardless, I feel like the awareness is there and the need for more communication about it is there. So as we are in this Heart Healthy Month, my hope is that we can really highlight some of the important people in the field that are there to help you and the different resources that are available for you. I feel like for families, that really is helpful to know that they have someone who's not just there looking at only their physical body, but they're there looking at their entire family-centered care.
Thank you for tuning in to our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.